Let me start with, it's always wise to start with disclaimers. So I have a couple of disclaimers. I don't know very much about evolution. I haven't thought much about evolution at all. And I will not be saying much specific and explicit about evolutionary mumblings. I've learned over the years that it tends to be wiser not to talk about things that you have no idea about. There are a few sort of peripheral things. That said, I'm going to be talking about channels and transporters. These two kinds of protein, I'm not limiting myself to holes, despite the, I'm not talking about evolution, I'm not limiting myself to holes, despite the topic of this meeting. I'm going to be talking about transporters and channels, and I'm going to be mainly talking about things at the level of function and of structure. And since so many of you actually do think about evolutionary issues, what I'm hoping is that, the things I say innocently may sort of provoke some thoughts in your own mind that may maybe have some link to evolutionary issues. And, if they do, please holler out and let's, just stop and talk about that. If I can keep myself from droning on, I will try to confine myself to just about an hour, and so that we'll have some time to talk about other things. The other thing I want to say explicitly is the few places where I do have a couple of explicit evolutionary mumblings all come about because of one of my colleagues in my department, a young bioinformatics guy named Doug Theobald, who's very interested in reconstructing ancient sequences and looking at function, structure, evolutionary relationships with them, and crystallizing, determining their structures. He likes to call himself a paleocrystallographer. And anything that I discuss about that will be because of calculations that Doug has done and discussions we've had. And I think you'll be hearing more about Doug in the future. I think he's an incredibly talented person. I have prepared three stories, of which I think I will only really get through two. So then I can talk at 10:30 tonight about the third one. I'll be sound asleep by 10:30. I'm still on Web Boston time.
You had strong coffee here.
Yeah, well, it doesn't work for me after 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So I'll be talking about membrane protein structures, transporter structures, and channel structures. And as you know, these are pretty few and far between these days. It's very difficult to crystallize membrane proteins. It's very difficult to express them, even just to get enough protein to even begin to think about crystallizing them. There are in this, and I'm just giving you a little background on this now, in the structural database for which we have, protein structures out there that we can look at the coordinate files and look at what the protein look like. There are roughly right now about 50,000 crystal structures deposited in the database. About 200 of those are membrane proteins. So that's what we're talking about. We are at the kind of the exponential foot of the growth curve of membrane proteins, that we're in very early days on that. The number of membrane protein deposits is growing. It's going about doubling every 3 years, and has been doing that for the last 25 years. The first membrane protein structure was determined 25 years ago, so that's zero time. So eventually that's going to level off, but right now we're nowhere near that. And most, and I will also say, most of the structures that have been determined of channels and transporters and receptors for that matter are of prokaryotic homologs, and that's not because we all love prokaryotes, although I do, but most of my colleagues only, you know, they all talk about the medical relevance of all the things they do and not trying to make the world better for E. coli out there. It's just the reason is a simple one, is that prokaryotic membrane proteins, though difficult to express at high level, are sometimes possible to express at high level. And eukaryotic membrane proteins, for reasons no one knows, simply, except in extremely rare cases, simply will not be expressed at high level in the usual prokaryotic expression systems and are pretty hard to get much out of some of the usual eukaryotic expression systems. So that's just a biochemical constraint and one of the main reason why there are so few of these membrane proteins in the database. It isn't that it's so difficult to crystallize them once you have them. The procedures for crystallizing membrane proteins are pretty much the same as they are for soluble proteins, with some little twists. But it's the ability to just get well-folded functional membrane protein pure, so you can just start thinking about trying to get a structure that has limited us over the years. So I want to just start by showing you a membrane.
Yeah. If this is irrelevant, then as usual, just tell me to shut up.
Shut up.
Is it?
No, I couldn't help it. When somebody says, tell me to shut up, I don't hear anything else. I don't hear any of the qualifying clauses.
Is the fact that you can't produce large quantities of membrane proteins, but you can of other eukaryotic proteins, is there any biological significance to that fact? I mean, is there something about the expression of membrane proteins and the way that it's regulated that is?
There is something about it. But we don't know what that thing is. We just don't know it. You know, my guess is that it has to do with Yeah, it's the complications of biology, the process of the machines that put polypeptides into the membrane as they come roaring off the ribosome. Those are different, and they're different machines in prokaryotes and eukaryotes. And
but that machine might be an interesting thing to think about.
Well, that machine is a very interesting membrane protein, and it's been crystallized, and we know partly its structure. And that.
Talking about that, what about, excuse my total ignorance, but the calcium ATPase, which makes essentially a solid SR membrane.
Yeah, right.
Can you express that?
That's a very interesting question. There are a few outlier membrane proteins. The calcium ATPase, as Bob says, is one of them. The acetylcholine receptor in the torpedo electric organ is another, which are in their natural membranes expressed and placed in the membranes at near crystalline density. And no one knows anything about the cell biology of doing that. And if, you know, I have for years been trying to, I'm not a biologist, and I'm certainly not a cell biologist, but I've been trying to convince some, you know, poor victim cell biologists, why don't you work on this question, is how does a cell, like a torpedo, torpedo is the electric ray that's swimming right out there off the beach, Torpedo Californica, it has these big hamburgers in its wings that are batteries, that are 60-volt DC batteries, and they are that because they have this huge concentration of a certain membrane channel called acetylcholine receptor in them. Why don't you work on how on earth does that cell do that and put those proteins in there at that huge density? If we could understand that and adapt it to a handleable, lab handleable system, that would be a major breakthrough. I mean, that, you know, sounds trivial, but that would just be, that would revolutionize the whole field.
There should be tremendous NIH support for that.
No, this
is a central issue in MS. People here don't know. The density of sodium and potassium channels at the node of Ranvier is also nearly crystalline.
That's absolutely true. Right.
Actual disease symptoms.
Well, Bob, you write the NIH grant. I don't think you'll get the money, but if you do, I'll take some.
So are you talking specifically about proteins that are involved in making channels or just all membrane proteins?
All membrane proteins.
There's definitely examples where people can overexpress proteins that are localized to specific membranes, cause huge proliferation.
Yes. These are the sex mutants and so on. Yeah, and that's been a strategy that people have tried over the years to try to exploit to get the high concentration, and it has simply not worked well in Cerevisiae. Just hasn't worked well as a general strategy for overexpressing your favorite heterologous eukaryotic membrane protein. And people have worked on that. Seemed like a good idea at the time, hasn't, we don't have any examples of membrane proteins that actually have worked with that. It's heartbreaking, but that's like a lot of crystallography is heartbreaking. So what I want to do just start is to get you to look at a membrane protein, and I'm going to just show you one that, you know, that'll try to illustrate a few properties that then you don't try not to forget them right away as I talk about some other proteins. So that is not a membrane protein. That's a potassium ion, as you can all see, because the 8 water molecules around it, coordinating it, are red, as Bob has established. So this is what, you know, this is one of the this is one of the coordination configurations you would expect to see from various molecular dynamic simulations and so on of a potassium ion in infinite dilution in a solution. But in fact, what you see is that potassium ion inside a membrane protein, and this is KCSA, the first potassium channel that was crystallized by Rod McKinnon and the structure solved. It's a tetramer. We're looking down from the top, from the extracellular side. It's made of 4 identical subunits around a central axis in this fourfold symmetry. That is a potassium ion that we're just peeking at from the top that is actually bound in there, and I'll show you some more. If we look from the impolite view of the channel, we see there's actually another potassium ion tucked in right there, and those two ions are separated by about 35 angstroms, and you'll see more in a minute. I'll show you the inside. That's just a this is what you do. You spend a lot of time choosing colors in this field. There's that top view. There's the side view. This is what you would see if you were a little flea living in the membrane. And we'll see where the membrane is in a minute. You see multiple potassium ions in there. And you see, specifically, you see there are 4 sites in this narrow place called the selectivity filter. That place, what I've done is I've just colored all the oxygen atoms within 4 angstroms of all the potassium ions. And what you see is there's this tunnel of red. It's a tunnel that's just lined with oxygens. And those oxygens are all coming from carbonyl backbones. which means you can't mutate them. You can't mess with them by the usual mutagenicide methods that we all use. This is that potassium ion that I showed you that I lied and said that's potassium in solution. It's actually a potassium you see in a wider place in this channel that's called the lake, that's a more hydrated region. These potassium ions here are dehydrated, but they are resolvated from these carbonyl oxygens that are supplied by the protein itself to mimic the potassium ion in solution. So that what basically the strategy this protein has used, and it's, you know, you think about evolution, that is a beautiful thing somehow that evolution has done. Maybe there actually is an intelligent designer out there. I don't know. You know, what it's done is it has made it so that for a potassium ion to slip through here involves, it almost is as though the potassium ion thinks that it's still in water, so that there are no huge energy barriers for stripping off water, and that would be just to dehydrate a potassium ion is way too much energy. But what it's done is it's made a kind of a watery mimic out of these oxygens, so that these ions can simply diffuse through in a largely dehydrated state as it goes through. And what we know is that potassium fluxes through potassium channels are often at the diffusion limit. They're as fast as a potassium can diffuse up to the channel. So it, from the point of view of a potassium ion, the channel isn't there. From the point of view of a sodium ion, it's a brick wall. So potassium-sodium selectivity for rates and for binding and other, you know, things tends to be experimentally on the order of, you know, something like 1,000 to 10,000 fold selectivity, very high selectivity. And those are, as Bob showed you, those are very similar monovalent cations structurally. There's not a whole lot of structure there, you know. It's not so hard for an enzyme to tell the difference between a D-glucose and an L-glucose. But, you know, when you're looking at the only difference being a very slight difference in crystal radius, this protein is a good inorganic chemist. Now, I don't want to get into this. I'm not going to talk about potassium channels, but I just love them so much I had to go on and drone on about this. I want to just show you a little bit. This is now what I actually want you to remember for the quiz later. And that is the kind of the chemical character of the protein. And, you know, we think of soluble proteins in water. They present to their solvent, their one solvent, one isotropic solvent, a surface that is compatible with that solvent. All membrane proteins basically have to deal with five different solvents in a highly anisotropic world. So what I've done here is I'm colored yellow all of the side chains that are alkyl, hydrophobic alkyl side chains, you know, just grease. So what you find is that the grease is really located in this band right around the center, you know, right around the belly of the protein, this band that pretty well by itself delineates where the greasy part of the lipid bilayer is. This is a band of 30, 35 angstroms or so wide, and matches very nicely with the typical lipid bilayer. You put the charged residues there. I'm not distinguishing positive and negative, but just make them all the charge residues are green, and it's very clear the segregation is obvious, and the reason is obvious because these are the two watery solvents on the top and the bottom. That's the watery world. And then there's another world, which is this transition zone. And this is a real world. Steve White has worked a lot on the thermodynamics of this, and it turns out that in the region where the lipid bilayer now goes through the polar phospholipid polar head group region. That's a kind of ambiguous and very complex, chemically complex region. And in fact, what you see in many, not all, but many membrane proteins are purple side chains there. The purple side chains are the two schizophrenic amino acid side chains, tryptophan and tyrosine. Because those are the two side chains that have, you know, they can sit in the grease with their hydrophobic bottoms and then look at the water with their hydrophilic polar tops. And you often find these bands of tryptophan and tyrosine around, right, sort of delineating the transition zones. And so the protein structures themselves kind of often tell you where their solvents are. This is no news to anybody. I just wanted to remind you of this because I think there are some points, evolutionary points.
Do all bacteria have the same thickness in the
microbiome? That's a good question. I don't know. I will assert, without proof or without data, that roughly most membranes in most prokaryotes are going to be about this size, but there will be, I'm sure, departures from that. And I should also say that it isn't as though the phospholipids are made of one species. The side chain lengths in typical phospholipids run from, you know, 16 carbons to 24 carbons, and they're a big mix. So this is a rough estimate of something, this kind of average distance where these tails, the lipid tails, are flipping around. But you shouldn't think of it as like a crystalline solid state. It's a real liquid state. Okay, that's all I wanted to show you about a membrane protein. Now I will go to the 320 slides on the PowerPoint. Why are you laughing? You want more? Okay. So again, I threatened to talk about two kinds of membrane proteins here. Channels and transporters, and of course there are other kinds of membrane proteins I'm not going to talk about at all, receptors, things that don't move solutes from one side of the membrane to the other. I'm going to confine everything I say to membrane proteins whose functions are to move things from one side of the membrane to the other. And these solute transporting proteins can be, I think, absolutely classed into two very distinctly different broad classes based on function and based on underlying mechanism. So there are the channels, and they basically move molecules, usually ions, but there are water channels, there are glycerol channels, there are channels for urea and other things. They move their solute across by the stupidest, simplest mechanism that you can imagine, even though you may not think the mechanism is so simple from what you heard from Bob yesterday, which is simply diffusion through an aqueous pore. The channels, of course, can't be open all the time, so these things go through an aqueous pore, just following their electrochemical gradients. They can't be open all the time, or you'd be dead, obviously. They have to be regulated when they open, when they close. And so they are based on there's some distinct conformational states when they're non-conducting, when they are conducting, and you know, you can add 27 states in a model to that and not be complicated enough. But basically, it all comes down to this. These are diffusive because the mechanism by which the solvent moves across the solute moves across the membrane is just diffusion. They are dissipative. That's not in the moralistic sense, but in the thermodynamic sense, they just fall downhill and dissipate free energy. The solutes fall down their pre-established thermodynamic gradients that are established by energy-consuming mechanisms elsewhere in the cell. And they're fast, and I'll come back to this, but typically, and you've heard this from Bob, typically the number of molecules per second that go through a channel typically could be, it's in the order of a million to a billion. We're talking about 10 to the eighth. A turnover of 10 to the 8th solutes per second, a turnover, a dwell time, if you will, of a typical dwell time of a solute inside a channel of maybe 10 to 100 nanoseconds. That's what we're talking about for conduction. And it has selectivity. So that's a, you know, that's been a long-standing issue of how can they be so selective and how can they, while being so fast at the same time. The other kind of, the other class are called pumps or transporters. I'll probably use the word transporters here, but the idea is these are totally different mechanism. These are proteins in which the way the solute moves across the membrane requires a concomitant conformational change with the movement. Notice, with the channel, it just has to open and then sit there. With this guy, every time the strawberry moves from one side to the other, the channel, the protein must undergo a conformational change. It has to bind it on one side, you know, do some stuff, and then dump it out on the other side. So every time the solute moves, it requires movement of the protein. And for that, and it turns out this kind of thing, a cycle in which you bind, you conform, conformationally change, you dump it out, so now you have an empty one. The empty one comes back to do it again, you have a cycle. That mechanism can be easily hooked up to an energy source so that you can now actually make the solute be transported uphill thermodynamically. And that's why these the mechanism is not diffusive, it's conformational, it's conservative, not in the political sense, but in the physics sense of the word. It conserves energy because it can convert the energies, let's say, of ATP hydrolysis to, you know, build up a gradient of an ion that can then be used to do something else. And it's slow, typically slow, because it's limited by the rate at which the bananas can flip their orientation. Typically, where these guys are talking about 10 to the 8th per second, typically we're talking about 10 to 1,000 per second for these kinds of guys.
Roughly speaking, just to make sure I'm apart, I mean, roughly speaking, that your 10 to the 8th comes from the diffusion time.
Diffusion time.
And the 10 to the 3 comes from the fastest that you can make conformation.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, again, these
sort of an order of one per time.
And because these, the solutes typically go one or two or three per cycle.
And it's probably not irrelevant that that's about the inactivation time of a channel.
Right, well, no, that's the 10 to 3.
Well, that's the 10 to the 3. I mean, all of the activation, inactivation, that this is, this rate here represents in channels the gating, the opening, the closing, the inactivation, and those are on the order of tens of milliseconds, 1 millisecond, which is the same order of this. Yes, so that all makes sense. Okay, these two kinds of mechanisms have generally been thought to be absolutely separated by a brick wall, and what I'm going to be talking about are some examples in which that wall has sort of melted down.
An evolutionary brick wall.
Mechanistically a brick wall. That these are really totally separate kinds of machines, and that anything that's built to be a channel is going to look totally different from anything that's built to be a pump or a transporter, and that they would have come from very different origins. That
you say it was really a social difference between those biophysicists who were trained electrically and those who were trained biochemically.
So we'll look at the structure.
Right. So this over the last 10 years has been melting down a bit, and I'm going to give you, I'll just try, hope to give you some examples of that. And by the way, I should also say, what I'm going to talk about is mostly not my own work. It's sort of, I'm in this field and I've done some of the work, but there are lots of very nice examples of that. I'll be referring to other people's work and I will probably forget to attribute them. This isn't a review, this is a discussion, so I won't be giving references and I won't be giving long numbers or names of people doing it. And because of that, then I'll be convincing myself I actually did that work. And that makes me feel good because I really like some of these experiments I'll be talking about. So the first story is I call it some evolutionary weirdness. So this is something that I'm going to make an explicit reference to evolution. And it has to do with something that in these early days of membrane protein structure that have been really accelerating rapidly in my, well, certainly for me, because I just got into this about 5 years ago. But the structures seem to be coming a lot faster, as an exponential growth will seem to do if you live in a linear world. What has become apparent, and this is the bottom line, and I'm going to try to show you this, what's become apparent is that there are a lot of unexpected structural similarities between proteins that live in what look to be, on the sequence level, completely unrelated families, phylogenetically unrelated. And you have to be careful, I think, about what we mean by phylogenetically unrelated. Obviously, I don't have to tell you guys that. I'm sure you are aware much more than I am of the problems of that. But let me just try this out on you guys, since you guys are the experts. So this is a protein. This was just published a couple of weeks ago. This is a new structure, and I'm going to start with this as an example of this strange similarity. It's a protein called, got to be careful about this, FOCA, and it is by sequence, it's been known in the database for years. It's a member of a large widespread family of transporters of organic anions. It's called the FNT family, for formate nitrate transporters. You find them everywhere in prokaryotes. You find them in a rather limited eukaryotic world, but there are a lot of those homologs out there. They haven't been much studied at the functional level, but this is a formate, this was thought to be a formate transporter. This is in E. coli. It's in, you know, the one that was crystallized was from E. coli, which just shows you how common it is in the prokaryotic world, if it's in E. coli. Well, anyway. So it has some, here it is, it's got six transmit. This is what the subunit looks like. It shouldn't tell you anything, except that's the membrane, and there are these helices that are packed in some specific way on each other. Now, this thing gave a few surprises. The first surprise was just looking at the structure. It wasn't a transporter, it was a channel. It had been thought to be a transporter because it was known it moves formate, and known its friend, its cousins move nitrite for certain housekeeping functions in the bug. And it looked, you know, six transmembrane, it kind of looked like a transporter. So that's how biochemists often work. Yeah, it kind of looks like it's a transporter. So let's call it a transporter. But it isn't. It's a channel. And you know that from the structure right away, by the very definition of channel, which is, it's kind of ironic. We've had the definition of channel is a structural, is explicitly a structural definition. It's a thing that has to have a continuous pore that goes from one side of the membrane to the other. And that definition came in the early 70s to all of us electrophysiologists sticking electrodes in cells and stuff, when there was no structure at all. It was an irony. But there were ways, functionally, we knew that those currents that we were all measuring had to come from a pore. I won't go into that. But the point is, this is the first example of where we thought we had a transporter, see that, whoa, it's a channel, because it satisfies the structural definition of channel. There is a pore going right through the center of this thing, and that pore, in that pore are bound two or maybe three formate anions. And so it's pretty well clear that was a channel. And I should say that, I mean, to be fair, although this family of membrane transport, FNT family, I should probably call it FNC family now, although it was known at the sequence level for many years, those hadn't been carefully studied mechanistically. So it's fair, it's not like some bozo didn't do the experiments right. It's just that they hadn't been much studied and were assumed to be transporters. It's rather beautiful arrangement in the membrane. If we look down on the top of the membrane, what we've got here, the way the subunits are arranged is in a beautiful pentameric arrangement around a central axis. But that axis is not the channel. There are five channels, independent channels in here. They run in through each subunit, and that central hole is actually filled up with hydrophobic side chains. This is not doing
it independently.
They don't know. They don't think they do. There's no evidence.
You haven't put this in a...
Nah. No one's done any electrophysiology. This is not my work. If you put this in bilayers and studied, you might expect to see some very interesting single channel properties where you had, five. It was every time a unit went in there, you get five different conductance levels.
I read the number four. I was getting a little worried about that.
Yeah, you...
Sorry.
Okay. You'd have a nice problem with that.
Yeah, right. Well, I have done some recordings and analysis of five individual SRK channels. Anyway, the surprise on this... Okay, now here's the surprise. So that's what it looks like. The surprise is that this FNT protein, this FOCA, lines up, if you arrange the subunit, it aligns structurally with a completely different family type of protein called an aquaporin. Now, aquaporins are water channels. They've been known for many years, and there are many structures, high resolution, beautiful structures of aquaporins out there. And it's either the purple that's the aquaporin or the other one that's the aquaporin. Anyway, the point is, this is supposed to look to you like a pretty good alignment. And if I could spin it around, if I were a better structural biologist, I would know how to make those movies that spin them around.
Does the aquaporin also have the pentagonal?
I'll tell you about that in a minute. So shut up. So the point is, this was totally unexpected, because there is not the slightest hint at the sequence level that these would be at all related, at all. And I should say, aquaporins are, again, another huge family, and they're found everywhere. Prokaryotes, eukaryotes, high eukaryotes, low eukaryotes, archaea, they're everywhere. So this was a surprise. And in fact, aquaporins do not... Okay, here's the answer to your question. Aquaporins have been known for a long time to be tetramers with four holes. Again, aquaporins are... each subunit is a channel for water in the aquaporins, and the middle is filled up with junk. This guy is a pentamer. So there are slight and very slight rearrangements in the folding that allow this thing to be slotted into a pentameric complex rather than a tetrameric one. But at the level of the subunit, these folds are extremely similar, but there's no sequence identity, similarity at all. Yeah.
In those members of this family, where they are transporters, the transport goes through the central
There are no transporters. These are all channels.
Oh, all these are channels.
All these are channels. They were thought to be transporters from sequence gazing.
They were named.
And they were named, but on the basis of nothing other than, oh, it kind of looks like it ought to be a transporter. And also because there's a cultural thing here. When the function is formate movement, you don't immediately think. Organic ion movement, you don't immediately think of channels. You know, for those of you young people in the audience, you should realize that doesn't include you, Ricard. That you should realize that there are a lot of things in science are driven by emotional backgrounds and stuff. We're all humans, you know, and I'm not criticizing it. We don't have to have our guesses when we don't have data.
I think this is actually quite relevant to what you're saying, that historically the people who looked at channels were trained in electrophysiology, how to build our own amplifiers, this sort of stuff.
Right.
And the people who looked at transporters, for the most part, were trained as biochemists.
Yeah,
used to,
right. Yeah, right. Grind up rabbits in wearing blenders. Yeah.
It's important for exactly what you're talking about, because it's hard today, isn't it, to give a real definition of a transporter?
No, I don't think it's hard. No, I would say, I think a transporter mechanism is still something that requires a cycle of conformational changes, and a channel mechanism is one that requires electrodiffusion through a pore. And I don't think those are melded or somehow confused.
But activation and inactivation.
Well, but that's gating. The part of all channels is that's just conformational change.
You had two Hodgkin-Huxley inactivation gates. It looks just like a.
Yeah, there are relations. Yeah, we'll go through that later. Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, it isn't. Yeah, well, I'll go.
Do these also exist as monomers and dimers?
They have never been separated. They seem to come, when they are made, they fold into this oligomeric structure, and you can't pull them apart. And that's common with many kinds of membrane proteins. Okay, so I think that's all I wanted to say about that one. But we're still in the first story, because I now want to give you a more elaborate example of structural sameness in phylogenetically apparently unrelated proteins. All right, this is a little more extreme an example. So this is the structure of a protein. We actually determined this and finally got the structure a few months ago. It's a transporter. It's an amino acid transporter. It's not a channel. No one ever thought it was a channel. It's a transporter of a certain kind, and it's called ADI-C, and it is blue and yellow. Basically, that's all you need to know. The membrane's here, and you know, worked on a long time. It was very finely satisfying to get the structure. Yes, it's an arginine transporter, and it has some other properties. It's a kind of transporter called an antiporter. It binds arginine here on the outside, moves it in. The cell, this is from E. coli, the cell decarboxylates the arginine, turning it into agmatine, which is just butane with an amino group here and a guanidinium group here, and then it moves the agmatine out. This is in a cycle that is involved in acid resistance in the bug. But that's irrelevant for what I want to say. It's an antiporter type and very specific for those two substrates.
Yeah, before you, can I just ask a question about biology that I should answer? Sorry. I mean, does everything you would want to think about transporter have its own transporter? I mean, is there
yeah, pretty.
Amino acid,
I mean,
like,
that's a good question. There are some amino acid transporters that are broad spectrum and will maybe transport, you know, 15 of the 20 amino acids. Won't transport histidine, arginine, and lysine, but will the others.
They're physically similar things.
Yeah, yeah, and then there are, within the same family, that phylogenetically, clearly in the same family, are other examples that are absolutely specific for just one amino acid. There, you can find both cases. I don't know it.
We teach the medical students that everything that the gut absorbs has its own transporter. What exactly that means.
Yeah, the SLC family, there are hundreds.
Yeah. There are literally hundreds of proteins
like the sense of smell. I mean, there are other things to the limits, I guess. So this like every,
No, there are only 20 amino acids.
Well, but there are lots of things.
There are a lot more smells.
There are a lot more smells, but there are many more chemicals you would want to transport than just amino acids.
Yes, yeah.
And
so
when we start to talk about that, maybe we start to get...
A couple of hundred.
GI physiology teaches, whether it's exactly right or not, we teach the medical students that everything that is absorbed has its own transport.
Yeah, but Michael, it's a very good point. I think the answer to it is that we have examples of poorly specific members of the family where it will take a lot of similar compounds and transport them, and other examples within the same structural architecture, in the same family, that are very specific. So we have both cases, and it probably, covers the gamut. If it didn't, we wouldn't be here. Yeah, and that's right. Of these hundreds that David mentioned, only a handful have been carefully studied and looked at the specificities and all of that.
Transporters are also can also be pumps?
So I'm using the word transporter and pump sort of interchangeably, just to denote a mechanism that's involved in conformational change cycle rather than electrodiffusion through a pore. So what we mean by a pump more, specifically is something in which a chemical reaction has been, the free energy released by a chemical reaction has been captured in that cycle so that the transporter can do work and move substrates uphill. This happens not to be one of those. This is one that is not hooked up to, say, ATP hydrolysis or, but the sort of thermodynamic principles are the same.
But the structural basis of things like the sodium pump are very different.
You bet they are, yeah. I mean, not all membrane proteins look the same. They are a zoo, a real menagerie of different shapes and sizes and everything else. Yeah, they're very different classes of functions and structures and sequences are very different too in these different classes.
So, specific transporters and non-specific transporters. Should I assume that if something goes through a specific transporter, it is not going through a non-specific?
No, you should not assume that.
It goes with much higher...
You shouldn't assume either of those things. This is sloppy, I guess I've heard evolution is pretty sloppy, too.
So, for example, and if you knock out the specific transporter,
In some cases, if you knock out a specific transporter, you don't kill the bug because there are these redundancies in the background. That some of which are maybe another similar specific transporter or this other, panoply of non-specific transporters. So you can't, there's not a clear assignment in the way you might want to.
Of course, the reason I'm asking the question is from evolutionary point of view.
Why do it? Why have a specific point? I don't know the answer to that, and I wonder about it, and I have wondered about it in another context that Bob is more familiar with, and that is outer membrane bacterial porins. Why? Bacterial porins are big holes. They are molecular sieves that just let things through that are, say, smaller than 600 molecular weight. So you have these porins that E. coli makes, let's say. But you also have some more specific porins that share the same membrane. Why would you ever want to have a phosphate-specific porin in a membrane that already had a totally big hole? Go figure. I don't know. It's the same question. Someone may know that. I just don't.
You need as many transporters as gradients you want, not as substances you want to move, right?
Well, It depends on the function of the transporters. Sometimes the transporters can either build up gradients or they can dissipate gradients. They can work in different contexts. So I don't think you can even make a clear and satisfying assignment in that way either.
Everything comes down to the expression levels. I mean, there are. Right? I mean, if the leak is a low express, so,
sure.
And that matters.
Sure, sure.
Because if you lived in a world where you know, the regulation, the expression of the non-specific channels was enormous, and there are only a couple of specific channels, there's no way I bet anything that that's not what's happening.
One of this ADC belongs to a family. Called the APC family of transporters. It's a very widespread family. We have it in mammalian. And one of the most famous APCs, this was the first structure of an APC, but the most famous in the literature, has been around for a long time. It's a non-specific amino acid transporter that in certain kinds of very fast-growing cancers is always overexpressed, presumably, because that's needed to feed those cancer cells. So that's actually something a lot of people have been wanting to try to I think it's futile, but try to get drugs against it.
For the evolutionary biologists, there's a huge and very specific literature about the outer membrane proteins of E. coli, how they're expressed, how the mutations appear, and how the specificity occurs that I use as a parasite to generate interesting molecules. But they're all of these things have been discovered by putting on artificial evolutionary
pressures. Yeah.
I mean, there are hundreds
right.
of things that are
right.
also going to be depending on cause if you make friends with Tillman Sherman.
Well, porins are early. Porins are these outer membrane porins were crystallized long before some of these other things.
Yeah.
They can. They're beautiful for manipulation.
Evolutionary model of these things.
Okay. So I'm going to just tell you another, as I say, after all these words, that means little. The point I want to make is that this is something we stumbled on that was, again, had seen the structural sameness in a very unexpected way. But first, I'm going to take a little detour before I show you that, to show you one other structural feature of ADC that has also been seen in many other membrane transporting proteins. And that is something called an inverted structural repeat. And what I'm going to show you here is really a remarkable thing. So ADC, the single subunit, and I should say, by the way, this is a homodimer I'm showing you. This is one subunit, this is the other. Each of these subunits is itself a full-fledged transporter. These just happen to be glued together for reasons no one knows. All right? So I'm going to just focus on this one subunit. This subunit contains 10 transmembrane helices. The first five and the second five have a structural similarity within the subunit, but you don't see that structural similarity. So this is an orientation standard here. That arrow is just shows you the orientation. I'm going to color the first five blue and the second five, the TM6 to 10 orange, whatever that color is. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to put an axis here parallel to the membrane and rotate the yellow guys 180 degrees, and that's what you get. And these guys line right up. Now that is amazing.
You're telling us that there's no sequence similarity between the first part and the second.
That's another issue. There is weak sequence similarity between the first and the second part. And I'm going to come back, I'm going to mumble an evolutionary thing about that in a little while. Yeah, I'm going to try to. And maybe I can have some help. but from a structural biologist's point of view, that's kind of surprising and wonderful and interesting and, fun. The functional significance of that is not known at this point, but there are some reasonable, plausible, and interesting hypotheses about that having to do with the kinds of movements that might occur in going from here to here. Certainly no one thinks that thing turns upside down and aligns itself, but that the fact that this side is structurally similar to that side has been postulated and some support for involved in whatever that conformational change might be. At this point, all we know is an outward-facing conformation here. We don't have the inward-facing conformation, so we're working to get that. So anyway, that is something that is seen in ADDIE-C, but it's something that had been seen before in other membrane proteins. And this has been, Eric Guo saw this in the first amino acid transporter that was seen at the structural level some years ago. This is a protein called LUT. This is a protein that has nothing to do with ADDIE-C. It's in a totally different family, and it, it's the phylogenetic. There's no sequence similarity, but it has also this 5 plus upside down 5 architecture. There are two other transmembranes hanging off there that are irrelevant to that. But this is also the idea is if you take this latter 5, turn them upside down, they align structurally in three-dimensional space well with the first 5. So that's a theme that Guo pointed out initially, and that also had been seen. Aquaporins have that. It's totally different. It's not 5 plus 5, it's 3 plus 3. But this is something. CLC chloride channels have that. That's not 3 plus 3. That's 7 plus 7. You know, it's crazy. But it shows up again and again. It is as though at some point, somewhere long ago, something was duplicated that had an odd number of membrane spanning crossings, and so the second duplication was upside down, and then they diverged in some way for some reason, God knows what. That's my evolutionary speculation.
Actually, there are documented, I mean, as far as one can document these kinds of things, this is known, and there are membrane proteins.
Oh, this is well known. This is well known, and there are many examples of it. Yeah.
But just to go back to your previous section, you said there was no sequence.
I see. Yeah.
You said there was no sequence similarity. This is sequence similarity with the structure lines.
Okay. With FOCA and the aquaporins, the earlier one.
But if somebody saw that, they would probably say it's the null would be that it's just that the sequence similarity has degraded over time.
Right. So that's a question I want to come back to at the end of this little section. That's the crucial question, divergence versus convergence. All right. So we'll come back to that in a minute. At this point, I'm just trying to illustrate to you that these structural similarities really exist out there. Yeah.
I have a really silly question. So why don't membrane proteins insert this way and that way with more or less equal probability?
They don't because of the insertion machinery. The polypeptide comes off the ribosome, gets threaded through a machine that knows the orientation. And so you never see membrane proteins that are multi-subunit going in both directions. And when I say never, I mean almost never. There's one weird example that's very controversial out there about this. So that's reasonable to think whether it should be random, but it isn't in cell membranes.
But in Chris's apparatus, this is a major experimental problem.
Yeah, you bet. When you purify the membrane protein and then want to put it back in an artificial bilayer to now measure its function, that, unfortunately, comes out unoriented, and you have to do tricks to orient the system. Sometimes you can do those tricks, and sometimes you just got to live with the two populations that you're living with. So, but that is not an evolutionary question.
Well, I'm going to say a question, I'd like to follow up with another sort of question, which is that given that membrane proteins are all asymmetric, How confident are you that the situation is the same going from one side to the other as the other side to the other?
What do you mean, the situation?
Well, I don't know. I mean, if you just look at your...
What situation?
Well, I mean, if you're on the passing line, I'd like to do the beautiful structure that you showed us today.
That's very asymmetric.
It's very asymmetric, but yet the way that it's described, physiologically, at least from what energy is going to be, it's very symmetric.
Current voltage relation of that, Bob showed you. You weren't paying attention, Michael.
I went too fast.
I'm not talking about voltage.
Well, when you're talking about...
Let's forget about gating. I want to talk about...
No, I'm not talking about gating. I'm talking about conduction. You get nonlinear rectifying...
You get diodes.
You get weak diodes, and sometimes you get strong diodes because of the... So if you look at a current voltage relation of a typical potassium channel with equal potassium on both sides, luckily it goes through zero. And then... But in general, you might get something like this. You might get something like this. You generally don't get Ohm's law out of that thing. And actually, it's very hard to get a linear IV curve in. So and that's just an expression of the asymmetric distribution of electrostatics in you know.
But that's when there's voltage. So I understand the charge being asymmetric part.
Well, the structure is asymmetric too. So you know, so you might have depending upon what the concentration of the ions are. You know, you might have a very easy access to one side and not. No, it's very relevant.
The rest is much more interesting. So
but just quickly, the first order equations are the same.
I think Bob has a few more slides on that.
It was my fault.
Hey, did you skip?
We can
class?
Address it in two sentences. The first order equations are the same as a transistor. Yeah. Those equations describe all the devices that a transistor can be. Okay, wildly nonlinear.
Yeah. Okay. So. All right. Yes. Yeah, Mike.
How are you envisioning that this happens? Do you think there's like an internal...
Some sort of... that's what they tell me. That's what they tell me. No, it wouldn't be an inversion. It would be... Suppose you had some proto... channel there that had an odd number of membrane crossings. 1, 2, 3, so that the C-terminus of this proto-channel ended up on the other side of the membrane from the N-terminus. Then you duplicated that and somehow fused those two genes. Now you would have an upside-down channel, you see? So that's the hand-waving notion, and I think it has not been tested seriously, but actually Doug Thibault is now working on that. He has some interesting results that I'm going to just mention informally about that, because I think it's a really interesting issue. This is an architecture. My only point of this is it's been seen in many times, but I'm talking about ADC and this LUT. It turns out I've used two totally different examples of transporter proteins in totally different families to illustrate this, but there's more to it. Because in fact, if you take ADC and you try to align it with LUT, totally different families, no phylogenetic relationship apparent. They align very nicely. And in fact, their substrate binding regions are right in the same position. So again, I emphasize, no one could see any sequence hints of one of the other. These are in totally different families of transporters. They do transport different things in different ways, but they have this structural similarity that's really remarkable.
Maybe I'm missing something. So they look like helices, right?
These are all alpha helical membrane proteins, and that's all I'm talking about in this alpha helical membrane proteins.
What is structural similarity exactly mean?
When you have 10 helices in the membrane, they aren't all parallel. They're at angles, they're packing against, sometimes they do this, they go in and decide to come back again. So they twist and they have a real packing structure just the way any soluble protein would.
I just want to make a comment. I think this is just a spectacular challenge for the audience. to define the way.
To listen to me. That's what my wife says to me.
There's a sequence challenge. I mean, I'm sorry.
Well, sorry,
there's a spectacular challenge to the audience, that is, those of us who have time to work, namely, to. There's got to be a way. I just don't believe it.
All right, let's go on.
There's got to be a way to do this.
No,
basically,
no,
sure.
There's easily the sequence identity could have gone. There's no.
No, I understand, but is there no signature left? I do understand what he meant, but there's no signature. Is there no signature? Well, we can argue about it later. But anyway, just trying to stimulate this.
So either a short answer. But so aren't there no, this is not my area of expertise, but aren't there programs where you can say, I have this protein, here's the amino acids, can I search the database of known structures, and does my protein align with those?
Are you align at sequence or structure level?
Structure.
I have this protein, do it. Yes, yeah, sure, there are search programs for structural similarity, and I will.
So could this have been found in that way?
Well, it could have been. It could have been. It would just turned out that since there were only five other membrane transport proteins of this kind of general character, we just I was the search program, right? I mean, I just tried doing a structural alignment. There are easy programs to do that. But yes, there are exactly right, and I'll mention one. There's a thing called the SCOP database, which is all the structural folds in proteins. But it gets worse. So what I've said here is, look, ADDIE-C has nothing to do with LUTEI, but they align rather well. And it's worse than that, because in fact, in the last 5 years, there have been five examples now of amino acid or other cation-like things that are transported. Well, I should just say, the small molecule transporters that we've had structures. As I said, we don't have many. We had five of this kind of general family of transporters. Not phylogenetic family, but just kind of, they move amino acids and other small organic molecules. And this is the alignment of ADDIE-C, the blue thing, with each one of those other four proteins in these totally unrelated families that are not related to either ADDIE-C or each other.
But they're sodium-driven, as you speak.
It turns out these guys that are gray happen to be a kind of mechanism called sodium-driven symporters. These are where you drive the amino acid uphill by allowing sodium to fall downhill with stoichiometrically with the amino acid. ADDIE-C is not such a one, but in fact, these others were. And this one does amino acids, this one does methylated amino acids, this one does uridine, this one does sugar. And each of these, by sequence, has a very wide and extensive family of homologs. Only one example of structure in each of those families. But these are all from well-known large families that go prokaryotic, eukaryotic, etc. But they all align very well together. So that's extraordinary. You have it struck a novice membrane protein crystallographer as kind of extraordinary that the first five things of that kind, of that ilk in the database, all lined up and were not related at the sequence level to each other. So that raises the question, is this strange or is this trivial? It's one or the other. I don't know which one, but let's talk about that for a few minutes. Yeah, is this structural similarity in apparently unrelated families of membrane proteins strange or not? Now, I'm going to give you, the question is, are these divergent from very ancient common ancestors, so ancient that all the similarity at the structure, at the sequence level has been wiped out, and you pointed out this easily to conceive of. Let me ask you a question then, because I've always, I'm gonna show you an argument that these are convergent. That is, that these are actually, because of certain special properties of membrane proteins, the membrane proteins are more likely to converge independently to similar structures. I'm going to give you an argument for what it's worth. But the question is, you know, what? So I'll ask you. Suppose they're divergent. That is, suppose they all do have a common ancestor way back there. They diverge, but it's so long ago that all the sequence similarity got wiped out. That's certainly something that's possible. Is it at all relevant to that hypothesis that you would find within one of these families, there is a wide, broad families, you can clearly recognize them as the same family, even though evolution has gone on just as long within that single family, and their functions are very different. So my question to you would be, if they're divergent, why would it be that you even have those families there that are clearly, you know, this archaean here is related to this mammal here within the same family? Their sequences have been somewhat conserved, and they're certainly recognizable, even though they are functionally doing now very different things in the archaean and in the mammal. So if that's that far apart, why did those not get wiped out where these did? What's the answer to that?
Well, I don't know, but it might be different from membrane proteins, but there are several examples of this kind of radiation around a given structure, but
right.
Huge structural similarity, but
no.
Very little sequence similarity in these two families. That kind of thing is found in other proteins in general, and the way they know that is
that
you can actually, there's enough other types of structures, not membrane proteins, where you can actually find some relation.
Oh, so you can trace, so this guy and this guy are not related, but this guy a little bit and that guy, so you can find a pathway. That's interesting. So I don't think anyone has looked for that with these. You should try that out. So I'm going to...
Categories are also not discrete.
Categories are not...
It can be convergent and homologous.
Oh, you're saying they're not mutually exclusive?
Yeah, there's a lot
issue.
Of gray
area. I see. Okay, all right.
Other types of structures like eyes, right? So we think that
eyes
that evolved in squid and our eyes are completely different and evolved independently. And now we know that they actually share some genes. So now it's a problem of defining what that means to be convergent. So there's the same mutational structures, and at some level, these all have this common ancestor, so they might recycle these parts and then arrive at the solution at the global scale that was convergent, but using the same sort of parts. So it's hard to say whether if we found alien life that evolved completely independently, whether it would arrive at the same structure or not, because there is this sort of deep homology.
Uh-huh.
It can kind of be a question of how convergent it was.
It's a construction issue. Is a Chevy different from a Pontiac? Is it different from a Buick? They come off the same assembly lines, and some parts are shared and some aren't, and so on.
Right, so if it evolved completely independently in an alien world, would it arrive? Is there only one way to skin this cat? Would you always get the same solution?
Right.
Or is it somehow due to the deep homology? It's probably both. It's probably that there is
some
a limited number of ways to skin the cat, but they also have some sort of...
Can I make an organizational proposal? So given that Chris has 250 slides left, and I would propose that we try as best as possible, and Boris has been pulling me down, trying to restrain from asking questions for just a little while.
All right. I'm going to come to, this is the last or the second to the last slide on this section. We can stop then.
I was urging you to stop.
But questions are good. I like questions. I like questions. It's better to have fewer slides and more questions, it seems to me. I think I disagree with you totally, Michael, on this.
One thing you haven't told us about yet is the assembly of these things, and I guess it's
the
question in a different way.
Yes.
There are only so many ways to assemble.
So I didn't say anything of the. I have shown you these similarities in structure on single subunits, but all of these five families that I'm using for the extreme example, they all assemble, or most of them assemble differently. Some are dimers, Some are trimers. One is a monomer. At just as we saw with FOCA and aquaporin, one is a tetramer, one is a pentamer. What do you mean by a symbol?
Putting all the parts together. If you're a tetramer, are they just?
Oh, how they assemble. The pathway of assembly is not known. I mean, that's really how you get. It's very fragmentary understanding of how multi-subunit membrane proteins grow and add subunits as they go into the membrane.
And this is also a difference between bacteria and
mammalian
cells and that there are chaperone proteins.
Yeah.
Mammalian cells that help these things hold.
Yeah. And help them, meaning they help them, but we really don't understand how they help them, I think.
They're a smaller subset.
I mean, all potassium channels are tetrameric, sort of. And all neurotransmitter-gated channels of the acetylcholine receptor variety are pentameric. And all gap junction-like channels are hexameric, and all ASIC channels are trimeric. And, you know, so there are certain presumably structural constraints for making a channel that happens. But again, we have FOCA and aquaporin, the one's tetrameric and one's pentameric, so, you know, go figure. The ones that I said are always, those are channels where the hole is formed at the axis. These other ones that diverge, that sometimes are tetrameric and some are not, are ones in which the transport mechanism or the channel is contained within the subunit. So that, you know, that certainly puts a big, less of a constraint on the way the thing has to be assembled.
The chaperone proteins are like scaffolds in buildings. So certain classes of buildings will have one set of scaffolds, but there'll be a different set of scaffolds for different kinds of buildings.
Okay, so let me just finish this section and we could quit or talk or whatever. So I want to now sort of explicitly talk about this issue. Is there any way to distinguish here common ancestor homology that's been wiped out in the long time of evolution from convergence to the same structure simply because of necessity, functional necessity? And what I would argue, I'm going to try to give you an argument that I don't believe, but I think it's worth considering the argument, that membrane proteins are maybe more susceptible to convergence because of a number of special things. First of all, membrane proteins live in 2.5 dimensions. They don't live in 3 dimensions as soluble proteins do. They don't have a single isotropic solvent. They have this very heterogeneous, non-isotropic 5 solvents they have to deal with, and they sort of have I say 2.5 dimensions because they just don't have the freedom of packing these helices the way you would in a soluble protein. They're confined to this kind of roughly two-dimensional space. So they are, I would say, they must be much more constrained already in their folding, and so there would be fewer solutions to the folding problem given a sequence there. That might be one thing that would drive convergence. Yeah.
At this point or another, you form the membrane.
Pardon me?
At this point or another, you form the membrane.
What do you mean you form them? The membrane's already...
Dynamics also, before they are confined to the two-dimensional space.
Well, no, actually, as they come off the ribosome, probably as alpha helices, they are essentially delivered into the membrane by this machine that lives in the membrane. It is itself a membrane protein. The polypeptide comes off the ribosome, threads through the machine. The machine says, whoa, membrane, go there, and lets it off.
But look, just to accelerate this, leaving to the side, this is the same point you made at the very beginning with the potassium channel with your beautiful colors. You know, there are patterns.
Yeah, that's what I'm coming back to. That it's more constrained for folding. Okay. There is also a reduced residue set that are going to be compatible with the lipid bilayer part. That is, we don't have 20 amino acids to use in the middle of the bilayer, as I showed you. It is, you may not realize this or appreciate it. You might say, oh, I could say the same thing for soluble proteins. They have to have polar residues on the outside. But that's not true. If you look at structures of soluble proteins, yeah, lots of the polar residues are on the outside, but there are plenty of hydrophobic patches on the water-exposed surfaces of soluble proteins. That's just the way it is. But you almost never find a charged residue or even a polar residue in a membrane-spanning lipid-exposed area, the solvent-exposed area of the middle of the membrane protein. Well, it will also be very energetically unfavorable to stick an arginine in there.
It would almost certainly produce a...
Well, whatever. For whatever, you know, I don't want to psychoanalyze the protein here, but I'd say you just don't find it. And you don't expect it, and you don't find it. So that you only have maybe, you know, often use 5 or 6 amino acids for that part of the protein, and that's a large part of the protein surface. So that's another big constraint on that. There are well-known electrostatic biases at the two interfaces. There's a thing called the positive inside rule for membrane proteins that is well established but isn't known why. You typically find on the cytoplasmic face of membrane proteins, arginine residues and lysine residues, and more negative bias on the external face. And so I don't know why that is, but that's a clear bias in the use of amino acids. So again, it's another constraint you don't see in soluble proteins. So the conclusion is therefore that membrane proteins should be more susceptible to structural convergence.
This electrostatic bias is not related to the question of Norris.
It's not that easy. Electrostatic bias is because of the way they thread it through. I think we should have a whole general club on membrane proteins that thread it through the membrane.
So I don't know about that. I just know the facts. I have never thought about the reason. Oh, I see what you mean.
But
is this your argument?
No. The membranes that these orient in may not have a potential across.
Yeah, that's right. You could see this at 0 volt. No, this is my argument simply that maybe this makes membrane proteins more susceptible to convergence.
But you just showed spectacular convergence. You showed the only 5 things you knew were the same.
Yeah.
That's much more convergent than this.
Well, I don't know that's convergence, though. It could be divergent homology, right? So I'm just trying to gather whatever, you know, mumblings I can think of to argue that maybe we see sometimes convergence in soluble proteins, but maybe we'd expect to see convergence a lot more frequently in membrane proteins. And I'm going to test that hypothesis now, or Doug is. Okay. Yeah. Okay, Boris? Yeah. All right. So this says, if that's true, then you would expect to see, if you started to survey, let's say all soluble proteins, look at the structural database, look at all the sequences, take an example of, here's the calculation. You just look at all soluble proteins and you ask, of all those soluble proteins that are phylogenetically apparently not related, that is, you do your blast search and you take a bunch of proteins, Doug took about 4,500 of them, that are by blast crappy. And now you say, and these are of known structures. And now you just ask, what fold does that go into? And you put it in a bin. You make a histogram of the known folds out there. So they're roughly in the SCOP database. There are roughly about 1,000 folds, we'll say, that are recognizable folds for soluble proteins. That's a lot smaller a number than the virtually infinite number of sequences you would choose. So you've got, let's say, roughly 1,000 folds. You now take all these proteins, you throw them into bins and say, how many in this fold, how many in that fold, and you make a histogram. And you make a ranked order histogram. So what you do is you just make a plot like this. You make a histogram of the folds. These are, with, as I say, about 4,500 non-related at the sequence level proteins of known structure. What folds are they in? And then you rank the order. So the most, the one fold that has the most counts here is about 3.5%, 4% of all the proteins are in that first ranked, that most frequent fold. And then the second most frequent fold is about the same, and the third most frequent fold is a little less, and so on and so on. You can, you know, just fit that to empirically to a power law or whatever function you like, you know. So it's a power law function. The point is, in that function, you can now imagine, suppose you had now a set of, you do the same thing with membrane proteins. You say, imagine you had all membrane proteins converge to the same fold. They're convergent. What would you have here? You'd have 100%, instead of 3% at the first one, you'd have 100% and drop down to zero. Well, if it was somewhere intermediate, you might expect that first, for the amplitude here to be somewhat higher than 3% and falling faster at a stronger power in the power law, right? So I'm just setting you up here. So now, can you do this? Well, you can, but it isn't real good because you've only got, instead of 4,500 examples, you've only got 200 examples of non-similar membrane proteins, but 200, you can do science. 200 is not zero.
Also, you can put error bars on the points.
Right. So, you know, we don't even take it seriously enough to put error bars, but...
You should do it because it's even interesting.
So here...
Only 200 soluble ones, right?
You could do that, too. You could do that, too. I mean, this is not a serious calculation. This is game playing.
It's interesting error bars. We're at the edge of our seats waiting for you to
click the button. Motivational.
All right. I don't know where the error bar should be, but that's what it looks like. I don't know statistics. And so any fool knows it goes down.
We can talk about that. Can we see the next one?
So here's what you get. So you work on this. You can do this properly. If you do it with membrane proteins, so now I'm setting you up, right? I'm setting you up to see that if you do the same thing, this is going to be, you know, 70% and then dropping down. And here's what it is. Ta-da! 3.5%. It's the same. It's, oh God, it's the same. All these arguments, oh, they're going to be there. It seems to have no effect whatsoever. I don't know. You could tell me that this might be sort of an experimental test of that hypothesis. I don't know. It looks like the same. So you know, notice all these? Notice all these down here? Guess what that number of counts in all those different folds is? One! Yeah, these are the ones, these are the twos, those are the threes, etc. But, you know, that's a kind of an interesting result, I think.
That's great.
Except not so fast, and that's where I'm, and I don't even have a slide on the not so fast, because if I now, this was done on a data set of the 209 known non-synonymous membrane protein, non-synonymous meaning one example from each family. 200 odd example. If I now restrict myself to only those membrane proteins that transport solutes, channels and transporters, now I'm down from 200 to 30. I'm not going to give that plot for 30. I'm just going to tell you this will be in the oral tradition. Okay? I'm not going to make that plot. You can make that plot. I got the numbers. I'm just going to tell you what it is. Guess what, from what I have now told you, I have a data set of 30 transporting proteins. And I've already told you that there's one fold, at least, that has five in them. And that I'm going to also tell you that's the most populated. So where does that start? Say it's 0.15 or so.
50%.
Yeah. So, see, you know. Yeah, it's 5 out of 30. It's 16%. 16%. So the first one is not 3%. It's 15%. Now, you tell me, is that a fluke? The second one is 2. 2 out of 30 is 7%. So you tell me. I don't know if that's significant.
But you just said that membrane proteins are hard to crystallize. Once you've crystallized one member of this family, all the other ones in the structural database are going to become this family.
Yeah, no. These are only one example from each family.
But it's the same structure. And so for whatever reason that this is easier to crystallize.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. You're saying there could be a bias in just the ability to crystallize. I'm not going to argue against that. There could be, you know, with these small numbers, you can have a big bias that you're not going to argue about with soluble proteins.
Yeah, it's a sampling problem.
Because it can be sampled. Yeah, sure. You can be, yeah, so that's why I don't have a slide on this, because I'm just telling you, that's what we have seen over the last 5 years is this remarkable, where is this coming from? It's the same structure. Whoa, I've seen this fold before. How can that be?
But it's a really great database, because the structures are so similar and the sequences are so divergent, you can ask a huge number of questions.
Yeah, and there are many homologs in each of those families. So, you know, this is what I was hoping to do. I don't know what you're talking about, actually, but I figured, good, I'm glad there's some use for telling you these disconnected facts. So, coffee time, yeah.
So I'd like to propose, you've got three stories, right?
I don't have to. I don't have to have three stories. You know, actually, let's say I have two stories. And
this is spectacular, so we have to keep doing. And you know, David, we're not going to let you off the hook either. If you don't, you can only
review.
Well, David is today, so this is tomorrow. Is that okay?
I mean, I could do that tomorrow, but you may be all sick of hearing this stuff by then.
We're not. Well, we'll go by line, actually.
Okay, so tomorrow, that was
all right.
Yes.
All right.
Is that it? I mean, we don't want to,
Sure, no, if you want me to drone on some more.
Before Mike even showed up, all these calm bunch of people, the next thing you knew, he was getting 4 hours of talks in a row.
All right. Chris has never been known not to talk, yeah. Right? You like to talk.
No, I'm very shy.
Yeah.